The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. In the Shishogi, which, as we all know, is a summary of great Master Dogen's basic teachings, the very first words that he speaks are these. The most important question for all Buddhists is how to understand birth and death completely, for then, should you be able to find the Buddha within birth and death, they both vanish. Now, I've heard some say that the use of the term birth and death is actually a way of expressing all of life. I'd like to consider it today from a different perspective, and that is that birth and death are both moments in time. We know that if we look at our birth certificate, I believe it's on there, the exact moment of our birth. I don't know how they choose the moment. And I'm sure that if I were to look at a death certificate, the exact time of death would also be recorded. We also know, if we think about it, that birth is recorded as a single moment, but it's a process that we undergo. We tend not to think about that one so much. We don't say, I'm borning, but we talk about, I'm dying. But in fact, death is a moment of time. And I'd like to suggest that so is life. Life is one moment in time, now, and now, and now, and now, and now. And that's what I'm going to keep coming back today, is the idea of living this life, which Dogen tells us is most important, is a matter of now. Later in the Shishogi, he says, should you live for 100 years just wasting your time, every day and month will be filled with sorrow. Should you drift as the slave of your senses for 100 years, and yet live truly for only so much as a single day, you will, in that one day, not only live 100 years of life, but also save 100 years of your future life. Now, there's a whole Dharma talk right there in that paragraph. I'm going to talk about one small part of that, and it's his statement, to live truly for only so much as a single day. And I think that today what I'd like to consider is what living truly means. In Rules for Meditation, that most of us are very familiar with, Dogen talks about what his words for living truly. He says to live in this way is the same as to live an ordinary daily life. I remember, I don't know how old I was. Maybe is it 6 when you first learn to do cursive handwriting? We would learn one letter every day. And do you remember the paper with the heavy lines and then the little light one in between? And we'd gotten to R. And I made an R. And I looked at it. And it was almost like something that had been two-dimensional sprung out in 3D. Because what I saw there was this perfect R. It was so beautiful, I can't tell you. And of course, if I said to the teacher, look at this, you know, it's like R. We all have these moments when suddenly ordinary life springs forth not just three dimensions, who knows how many dimensions. It's transformed. You can't plan it. And as I'll tell you in this next story, you can't ever recapture it. I've told this story before because I still can't imagine what I was glorying in, but I was not a lot older than when I wrote R, and I was out with a friend, and we were making mud pies. And we had mud, and we must have had jar lids or something where you pack it all in, and you turn them out, and there are these little things. And we'd gone through the trash and found an old used-up tube of toothpaste. But if you got a stick, you could get in there, you know. So we mixed this peppermint toothpaste into the mud, and there were these mint chocolate cakes. It was magic. You know, it was really magic. So, you know, the next time it was muddy, I thought, well, let's get the toothpaste. But you can't do it again. It is something in life that when life suddenly springs forth, it does it unannounced and with no help. And of course, trying to recreate it simply leads to real disappointment. Leaping ahead over a lifetime, I came here in March of 1990. It was my second visit, you know, after an introductory retreat. And I was here for the Jukai week to take the precepts. And in those days, we had the five great Jukai ceremonies. We didn't do renewal of vows. So in a six-day retreat, there was one day where there were no ceremonies scheduled. And so on that day, we got up, we ate breakfast, we went out and did working meditation. We meditate. That's, you know, it was just what we all know as being an ordinary day here. When I went home, I mean, it wasn't that I didn't remember Jukai, but in that one day, it had been such a perfect day, I can't tell you. Nothing out of the ordinary happened. You know, there were 65 people here, so there were something 30, 40 women trying to share the bathroom up at the guest house. Everything flowed. Everything was perfect without anything being special. When I say perfect, what I mean is it was, I recognized that difference. And I suspect that that day is one of the things that really hooked me about our practice. Is the fact that you could do ordinary, everyday things and yet have it transformed in such a way that you're living in a way you never experienced before. Setting aside all the peak experiences in the world and, you know, wonderful celebrations of family successes and all of those things, that ordinary day stands out for me just like the day I wrote R. As something. As many of you know, shortly before Christmas last year, I received a diagnosis of lung cancer. And I'm going to talk not in, gory details about, you know, my medical experiences and all of that, but the last year, much of the last year, has appeared to me in the same way that I saw R. And I'm going to try to tell you a little of what happened or of how it was, because for all of us in our life, there's something. There's an opportunity that doesn't look like what you expect an opportunity to look like, but there's an opportunity to not only live truly, but to experience in an extremely real and continuous way what it is that we're practicing here as Buddhists and what it is that we've been taught and what it is that our training gives to us. The first thing I'd like to talk about is the very first experiences I had as this process unfolded. You know, during that past year, it wasn't like I felt anything was wrong with me. There was just something different. And, you know, I had a couple of x-rays, and they didn't show anything in particular, but there was still something, and it, you know. So finally I had a CT scan and then went off to see a pulmonary specialist. And this was the first experience that set the stage. This tall, friendly-looking man walked in the door of the little, you know, examining room that looks like every examining room you've ever been in, and puts his hand out, shakes hand, introduced himself, and the first question he said immediately was, "When did you first take refuge?" And so I started down this path side by side with a member of our family. And, you know, we went on with whatever you do with those kinds of things and finally got around to going in and looking at the pictures of the scans that had come with me. And I'm looking at this and I say, "What do you think when you see that?" He said, "Cancer." But that was fine because we were both, there wasn't any need. This was a practicing person speaking to a practicing person. He didn't say it in any harsh way. It was just, this is what it is. And it was just fine. But what it meant was the very first thing that happened when I started down this road is someone reminded me, "I take refuge in the Buddha." And that's how it started. So from there, I was sent, you know, things kind of went on a fast track here. Early the next week to have a procedure done. And I went for it, and I wasn't, you know, thinking anything about it. They were going to stick something down and look. And as I was being prepped, they said, "We're going to bring you this inhaler because we want to deaden things so that, you know, won't feel what's going to go down. And all you have to do is sit here and just inhale this stuff until it's all gone." And then he left the room, and I'm there with this inhaler. And I didn't think much about it, but, you know, very quickly something happened, and that is my entire tongue went numb. And so I felt like I was choking on my own tongue. And you know the panic? Something, there must have been a space, because something stepped in there and said, "All you have to do is take the next breath. Don't have to do anything else. Just take one breath, and then take one breath, and then take one breath. Now, now, now." And the panic just, you know. And when I think about it, you know, I have no memory of walking around with a dead tongue for the rest of that morning. The only time it was the panic was when the panic was there. I take refuge in the Dharma. The Dharma teaches us now, you know, just this one thing. So they did the procedure, and I got a phone call a day or two later, and he said, "Well, you know, we went in there and scraped stuff, but we didn't get anything, can't really tell." So he was going to make a referral to a surgeon. And I thought, well, next thing that's going to happen is I'm going to go up and, you know, have a nice appointment with somebody, and we'll kind of talk about stuff. And a couple of days later, the phone rang, and this very pleasant woman said, you know, "Is this Maxine?" which is my legal first name. She said, "I'm calling to make an appointment to remove part of your left lung." And my mind wanted to say, "What?" You know, it's like, I said, "Excuse me, what did you say?" Panic, you know? And she said it again, and I said, "When were you thinking of this?" And she said, "Tuesday." You know, it was probably Thursday or Friday. And again, this little space. I said, "Could I call you back?" Of course, you know. So I got on the phone, I called Reverend Master Mayon, said, "Can I come down to your house, please? I take refuge in this Sangha." And of course, it was fine. You know, it was the next thing. And so next Tuesday, we got on with the show. Somewhere between, actually accepting the appointment for surgery and going for it, something else happened. And this is something that I don't know how to describe, but I was, it began a long, long period, probably 2 or 3, 4 months, of feeling two things. One is intense, quiet joy. And the other is the sense of being completely held. So I didn't have to worry or be afraid or, you know, naturally you get nervous about stuff. You know, it's, I don't like people putting IVs in my arm. I don't, you know, so I can get real tense around that, but that's such a small thing. I didn't feel compelled to go on the internet and research diseases or outcomes or treatments or any of that. It was just, you know, this is what we're doing. Now you go here and this is what's going to happen. You know, and then it unfolded. I had surgery and all of that. And I was in the hospital for about a week. And while I was there, I began to notice some differences. You know, I went through large part of my life feeling like I was an invisible person. So that what that means is that if you go to see the doctor, you're not really a whole person there. You know what I mean? I mean, he's there and you're there, but you know, you walk out the door and you're forgotten. And the same thing happens in reverse. You know, experiences that I have once I've encountered people and they're not in my vision, they're not really connected experiences in any way. This, of course, is alternating with those moments when I'm convinced that I'm the center of the universe. But I had a number of experiences in this process which were also a gift, because I had the experience of being able to have very intimate kinds of experiences with people I didn't really know, and some of whom I can't even remember their names. And I'll just mention a couple of them. You know how it is, if you've been in a hospital bed, there you are, and you know there's tubes every which way, and you need, practically, it's like someone going on safari. You need bearers if you're going out for your physical therapy, because people have to wheel the eye, you know, all that stuff. And you're lying in bed all the time, and you just start to feel kind of yucky. And somewhere midway in my stay, there was a nurse. I know it wasn't her job. She was a very, very kind person. And she came one evening right before she was going off duty. And I know this was extra. She said, "How would you like a sponge bath?" You know, got me out of bed, took me in the bathroom, warm, soapy water. I felt so cared for, not because I was, you know, she wasn't doing this because I was special. She somehow knew that a person who was in the condition I was would really appreciate something like this. I don't even remember her name. You know? Now, I got my comeuppance a couple of days later. You know, every day, if you've been in the hospital or visited in the hospital, you know, every day they come in on this board, they write down who the nurse is going to be and who the nurse assistant is and all of that. And there was a new nurse assistant for those couple of days. And she was very efficient, very particular. And if you're lying in bed, you try to move the equipment around so you can use it and get to it. Every day she came in, she'd quickly put everything back where she thought it ought to be, which of course wasn't where I could use it. One time I was sitting in a chair and talking to someone, and there was a pillow there and it fell off onto the floor, and she came in. First thing she said is, "I see you didn't like the pillow where I put it under your feet." I was not in bliss land. I mean, you know, this amidst all of this, it was a real lesson to me because my critical mind was right there. You know, every time she walked in the door, I was ready for her to annoy me. So I had turned her in to a person who is annoying. I remember her name. And I mean, isn't that a lesson? What do you remember? You know, the stuff that you don't like. You know, the days of pleasant people coming in and out, treating you nicely and not kind of rubbing you the wrong way. We don't remember. I remember her name. One more thing I'll tell you about, just that was part of this discovery that was going on in my interactions with other people. After I got out of the hospital and after it was determined that the plan was going to be chemotherapy, you know, you have to go get something installed so they can plug the chemotherapy into it rather than run it, you know. So in my case, they were putting something in my arm, which was go into the chest. And it is scheduled for an hour and a half or so. And I went in, really nice woman, who told me first off that this was really a special day for her because she really likes, everybody likes to do this procedure. And so they all know when, they do it in turns, and you always know when it's going to be your turn. So it's not only were we going to do this thing, but I was presenting her with a treat. And you know how things go. You're setting up all this stuff, sterile this and things here and things there. And meanwhile, she's kind of telling me about her life and where she lived before and all of that. Meanwhile, of course, there was a television on with no sound and somebody was cooking. There were people cooking up there for the entire time. So everything was ready. We're ready to start. She said, I can offer you a shot of something. I gather it's something that will make you not really care what's happening to you so much. You know, and I said, well, actually, no, I'd rather not do that. And so we started, and, you know, everything's going along, and she's watching on this little screen how it's going. And all of a sudden she said, may I ask you a favor? Because she said, all the time I do this with people, and I have to tell them what's going to be happening next and what it's going to feel like. And you know what it's feeling like. Would you mind telling me when we go along? You know, I'll ask you, tell me what it feels like. Is it pressure? Does it hurt? You know, and all of that. And it was really interesting because suddenly this stranger and I were doing something together that was, again, there was an intimacy about it, which has nothing to do with how well you know the person. So this was going along, and she was almost, I gathered, almost close to getting done. And then she said, can you feel my hands trembling? And I said, why are your hands trembling? She said, my hands always tremble because much as I enjoy the challenge of doing this procedure, there's always the possibility I could do something wrong. And I would be willing to bet she'd never had a chance to say that out loud before. I don't remember her name. I had this feeling that somebody must along the road must have been called Mary, because I what comes to me is I don't remember her name. Maybe she was Mary. So what does this have to do with living truly? I thought about this a lot, and I would add, in here that as this was all going on, it wasn't formulating in my mind. You know, I wasn't recognizing when the doctor walked in that I was taking refuge in the Buddha. But my reflecting on my experiences made me realize how the teaching was weaving itself through everything that happened. Somewhere along the line, what kept coming into my mind was this. All acceptance is the key to the gateless gate. And I began to be aware that the practice of all acceptance was vital to what was going on and what was going to be going on during the time of recovery from surgery, of going through chemo, of living through the spaces. Actually, chemo's not bad. It's the time in between them that is harder. But that all acceptance, as opposed to all the other possibilities that the mind can come up with, all acceptance was going to be key. Acceptance is nothing more than the acknowledgement of this is what it is right now. This is what's happening right now. This is what I have right now. This is how I feel right now. This is how I'm reacting to what's going on right now. The other alternative is me back in the room waiting for the nurse's assistant to come in who's going to annoy me. This is how things are right now. This is how either I'm afraid things are going to be, or how I expect things to be, or my opinion of how things are. This is how it is right now. This is what I have. It's not good. It's not bad. It's here. It's now. That's all. I don't remember who quoted a John Chaw, but that to saying this. But he told one of his monks in Thailand, who I gather was complaining, if it wasn't supposed to happen, it wouldn't have. This is what was happening, and there was no point in going either way with that question as to think that it shouldn't have or how it could have been prevented. You know, once you're in the middle of it, you swim. You know, it's not resignation. You know, it's not putting up with what's going on. It's not thinking it's fate. It's none of those things. You're just sitting in that chair right now, and that's it. You know, you don't have to worry about what is going to happen next. This is where we are right now. This is where we sit in the meditation hall. We just sit in this body, in this place. Sometime after this all acceptance is the key to the gateless gate came into my mind, I started reflecting on the question, what is it that we find if we enter the gateless gate? You know, what is there? Well, the fact of the matter is, if it's a gateless gate, actually it isn't there, it's here too. You know, there's no separation. And I was walking along across the garden here one day, and something came into my mind. This is from my long ago junior high and high school Baptist days. It was the phrase, the peace that passeth all understanding. And I thought, you know, that's it. That's what the gateless gate opens to us. is that peace that passeth all understanding. Now, I was crossing the garden when that came into my mind, so first thing I did is go to my room, and you can find anything on the internet, because I didn't know what, that's a phrase, I didn't know what that came from. And I don't know if this is what kind of translation this was, but what that, the whole verse is, and the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Well, for us, we don't think of the peace of God, and we don't think of Christ Jesus. But we're all familiar with teachings that talk about experiencing that which transcends our intellectual mind, which transcends all understanding. Peace is not an intellectual concept. If you are at peace, you know it from the top of your head to the bottom of your toes. And you can be at peace in the most astounding circumstances, which certainly would transcend all understanding, you know. The other phrase here is guarding your hearts and minds. We talk a lot about that our practice is about the harmony of body and mind. And so this peace, which transcends all understanding, is a peace that comes to our total being. All of our senses, including our mind, can be at peace. One of the basic practices for us is mindfulness. And I had a lot of trouble with that word for a long, long time. I thought mindfulness meant total concentration to the exclusion of anything else in my immediate surroundings. So if you're sweeping, it's like, this, you know, that's it. If you listen to the way mindfulness practice is described by the teachers from the Theravadan tradition, they don't use mindfulness, the word mindfulness, as often as they use awareness. And I've even heard one teacher who likes to talk about bare awareness. I didn't get that for a long time. But it's awareness with nothing added. It's just simply being aware. So if we're sitting here or if we're sitting in the meditation hall, we're aware that we have a body, we're aware that it's sitting on something, we know where we are, we know that people are around us. Mindfulness practice lets everything in that's within our awareness without taking us away from awareness. Awareness is aware. The mind can notice what we are aware of or not. You know. A lot of times, the example's often given of just hearing a sound like birds singing, and you know that birds are singing, but you don't stop and try to analyze the pattern of the bird song. It's just simply there. And the reason I'm talking about mindfulness and awareness is because this is the ground that all acceptance takes place within. We're aware of conditions, and we can accept those conditions. We have a choice. Now, going back to the nurse's assistant who wanted to move all my furniture, she was a person who really paid close attention to her job. She wanted things to be nice in the room of the patient she took care of. She clearly thought about what was the best way to do things. That's, in fact, what was there. I chose to see something else. I chose to look at motives, not just at what was happening. That was not acceptance. She was making an offering. I didn't accept it. And I'm sure that I do that a lot, you know, but I hope she'll remind me that I'm missing seeing the truth of what's happening right before my very eyes by instead choosing to look at my mind and opt in for the judgment rather than what my awareness could tell me. I think a real key to being able to look at how we approach acceptance is this. Whatever is happening around us, whoever is in front of us, whatever the conditions are, do we see them as me sitting here and you sitting there? Me sitting here and the snow happening out there, that there's a separation. When there's all acceptance, it's living back again in the place where R is beautiful, you know? And it isn't that you have to love everything. It's a matter of not choosing to see it as separate and other. We can choose to live in harmony with what is going on around us without having to vote. As a matter of fact, if we vote, we've moved out of all acceptance again. We don't have to be for or against. Suspending the mind that wants to decide whether things are good or bad, for or against, and all of that. The mind that dwells there leaves no space for something as important as compassion or wisdom. The mind that judges takes up a lot of room. The heart, living from the heart, never requires that we get rid of anything. You know, we don't have to fight against anything. And it's the heart that lives in harmony with everything, not by accident, but by choice. Now, I'd like to add one last kind of addendum on the subject of living with something like cancer. Not too long ago, maybe 3-4 months ago, I got an email from a cousin of mine who was passing news to the rest of the family about his sister, obviously another cousin of mine, who at the age of 64 had just died of brain cancer. And in the email, he included an excerpt from the email that was sent out by the husband of the cousin who died. Her name was Tony. And he said, "This tumor has been the monster in Tony's life for the last 5 years." You know, and how sad. When shortly after my diagnosis, an old and very dear friend of mine sent me a book about this thick. It was all about cancer. It was called The Emperor of Maladies, I believe. Anyway, it was a history of humankind's association with cancer, you know, a medical history, if you like, of what people thought it was in the time of the Greeks and then over the years and up to modern days. And the one message, if nothing else, I won't remember any of the details of that history. It was a wonderful book. But that cancer is me. You know, and our bodies do what create cancer all the time. I mean, our bodies do all kinds of things. But that to fight a war against cancer is to go to battle against myself. And I think that the mind that's at war will never find peace. The joy that I started experiencing from the beginning, I think that's maybe the active expression of what joy is like. It's no accident, you know, at the holiday season, what do you get see on cards? You wish people peace and joy. They go together. And so the whole idea of acceptance has its, you know, the practical example in its opposite, which is choosing to go to battle against part of yourself. And what do they say? You know, it's like so-and-so died after a 5-year battle against, you know. I've never heard people going to battle against strokes. You know what I mean? It's but you know, I'm sure it has its equivalent. So just in summary, what I'd say is this whole experience in one sense has been nothing more than what we do every day when we go to our cushion. In this moment I can be still. And in the next moment, and in the next moment, and in the next moment. That's what we practice day after day. And if we are fortunate, we have the opportunity to have something arise in our life which challenges that. Not that we can't, not challenges our ability to be stillness, to be still, but challenges us to show to ourselves that when that challenge comes, we know to sit right then. Doesn't matter where you are. To sit still right in that moment. You know, when you're breathing the stuff and you think you're going to choke, sit. And I think that's what truly living. You know, I'm sure it's not the whole of it, but I'm sure it's a part of it, a big part of it. And I hope you know that I don't think that I'm talking about this as any kind of suggestion that I'm doing wonderful practice, that I had miraculous experiences or anything like this. This is all so ordinary. It's really no different than just how we live every day. The details are just a bit different. And one last thing, my gratitude, you know, to the community here who made it possible for me to just do this and not have to. I can't imagine what it would have been like if I were the single mother of three and this had been happening to me and I had to carry on and, you know, make the dinner and sweep the floor and all of that. To all of you, kind words, cards, emails, that's part of what makes us know when the challenges arise that we're being held. So thank you.